Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Federal Highway Trust Fund that has fueled construction and maintenance of our interstate roadways is running on empty and could conk out as early as August. Federal highway programs have been financed with federal gasoline taxes, but those tax rates have not changed in more than 20 years, and there's no apparent appetite in Washington to make a change. An alternative is pay-as-you-go with toll roads. President Obama's $302 billion transportation proposal would, among other things, change federal law to permit states to add tolls to interstate highways for maintenance and improvements. Coming up, we'll hear two sides to the tax and toll issues. Joining us now is the transportation reporter for WAMU Public Radio in Washington, D.C., Martin DeCaro. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Why is the Federal Highway Trust Fund running out now? Or should I say, why are they making a big deal about it this year?
Well, this comes up quite often. There hasn't been a, and I'm going to use the word long-term loosely, there hasn't been a significant multi-year transportation funding bill passed for about a decade. So every couple of years, we find ourselves in this situation. It's running out because the fund that provides the money, the revenue source, the federal gas tax, according to who you ask, isn't high enough. It hasn't been raised since 1993 when Bill Clinton was in office. That was 18 cents a gallon. Really has been raised to pay for transportation since Ronald Reagan was president. The last two times, including under Clinton, it was for deficit reduction and then eventually transferred over to transportation. And it's coming up now because, well, a couple of things. First of all, by the end of this summer, the Highway Trust Fund is expected to be insolvent. That doesn't mean it hit zero. It just falls below what's considered a critical level of $4 billion. And number two, the current two-year, $100 billion transportation spending measure that Congress last passed is going to expire in September. So they need a new spending bill. The administration is proposing a four-year, $300 billion plan. Senate committee yesterday came out with a six-year plan that would keep funding at current levels, and it's unclear what the House is going to do with that. So we have competing plans in Congress, and we have the pending insolvency of the Highway Trust Fund. That's why it's a big issue right now, and of course it is becoming political.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Martin DeCaro. He's transportation reporter for WAMU Public Radio in Washington, D.C., about the Federal Highway Trust Fund finances and what we do instead to pay for our interstate highway system in the United States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. So, Martin, what happens if the trust fund goes into default? What would the states do?
Well, states are already nervous about just the uncertainty. Essentially, states can't plan, and then if there's no money for them, they can't continue construction. It's not expected that it's going to reach insolvency. Every time we get to this point, Congress usually passes a short-term funding measure, which involves several things, including transferring money from the general fund over to the Highway Trust Fund because the gas tax is not providing enough money. So we're not expected to hit insolvency. Congress will do something. Now, it's an election year. Congress is already divided along partisan lines. There are a number of issues that they're not expected to take care of, including immigration reform. We all are familiar with what's going on Capitol Hill. Transportation, just one of them. So the experts I speak to, policy experts, say it's unlikely that Congress is going to approve of the administration's four-year, $300 billion plan. Not impossible, but unlikely. And so they'll pass something short just to patch us over to the next transportation funding crisis.
How much have our expenses changed since 1993 when there was the last gas tax increase?
What do you mean by expenses?
How far behind is the revenue stream from what we actually spend?
Oh, okay, good question. So the experts say to just get the fuel tax caught up to inflation, you'd have to increase it by a dime immediately and bring it up to 28 cents a gallon. So everything is more expensive now. Labor costs, construction materials, everything that you put into building a highway, everything has gone up significantly since 1993, except for the fund that we use to pay for this. So when people complain about the state of their roads, we need more lanes, we need more transit options, because the Highway Trust Fund is about 80-20 highways transit. We need better bridges. We're talking about maintenance and new construction. The Highway Trust Fund covers both. And then you ask them, okay, so are you willing to pay more money for that? They say, well, not really. Not everyone. I think, you know, I think a lot of people would be willing to pay if it's explained to them what it's going for. But so there's this divide, right? We need all these things. No one disagrees. I shouldn't say no one, but most people would agree that we need these things, right? We have to improve the state of our infrastructure. It's vital to our economy. But when it comes to coming up with a solution for that, that's where we have these divisions. Now, Secretary Fox, the transportation secretary, gave a talk in downtown D.C. yesterday, and I asked him directly, why hasn't the administration taken a more assertive position for a long-term funding solution in which you would have to go directly to the American people and convince them what the money would be paid for? A lot of people, you know, they say, okay, well, I'll put more money into the Highway Trust Fund as long as it's going to go toward what it says. Don't take money away from it and spend it on other things.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, when you look at Europe, some European states, they have very high gas taxes, but they don't use that money to fund transportation. They fund it out of the general fund. We do the opposite here, and our Highway Trust Fund continues to run out of money, so we wind up having to transfer money out of the general fund anyway. Matter of fact, when the fiscal year began, there was only $1.6 billion in the highway account. It required a $9 billion transfer from the general fund just to get things going. And now we're down to about $3 billion as of late April. Or I should say, I'm sorry, $8 billion as of late April. So about $3 billion had been spent. But now that we're reaching the height of the construction season, that $8 billion is not expected to last very long.
You mentioned that the president's proposal is a four-year, $300 billion plan. The Senate's proposed a six-year plan. The House possibly will produce its own plan. But in terms of planning for something like transportation for a country like the United States, a lot of analysts will say you have to look 10, 20, 30 years into the future. Is there any sense that that's happening at any level in Washington?
No.
Okay.
Well, I should say among some people, yes, but not enough. And you're right. We're talking about projects that have decades lifespans. And when you're talking about planning for the future, you do have to be looking far ahead of time. You just can't always be focusing on bringing what you have up to a state of good repair and be fretting about whether the funds for even that will be necessary. You know, just here in the D.C. region, we're seeing next-generation transit take over. We're seeing the city become more bikeable, more walkable. We're seeing a move away from the suburban drivable model of just paving highways to answer all of our transportation solutions. So some of the projects that are underway just in our region, we have rail lines being built out to Dulles Airport, mm-hmm. a light rail line north of D.C. in the Maryland suburbs, a 16-mile light rail line that's going to take about $2 billion to build, half of that federal money. How is the state of Maryland supposed to plan for that if there's all this uncertainty in Washington? It makes it very difficult. So, yes, there needs to be that type of long-term planning, but all this indecision in Washington and these two-year patches just to get us to the next funding crisis make that type of planning very difficult at the state level. But and you mentioned in the beginning, sorry to interrupt, mm-hmm. but one of the proposals in the administration's plan is to allow the states more flexibility right. to toll interstate highways to generate revenue for themselves.
How big of a deal is that?
Oh, it's a big one because it's going to be opposed by a lot of powerful bodies. You have motorist groups, trucking groups, the usual people who don't want to pay more tolls. They look at it as a double taxation. When you think about it, it really isn't, because the federal gas tax isn't getting us there.
Mm-hmm.
So the administration's proposal would allow states more flexibility. You can toll, when I say you, being a state, mm-hmm. states can toll interstate highways now. However, they can only do it if they add capacity. You cannot toll existing capacity. You have to provide at least that free option for motorists, and then you toll the new lanes. In Northern Virginia, the 495 express lanes on the Beltway opened 18 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
They added two lanes in each direction, so four new lanes of capacity. It's an easy pass only express lane, and the toll for the 14 miles that they're intact can go anywhere from $5, $6 to $10 if it's really busy. So Virginia is doing that, but that money is actually going to a private sector firm that built the highway. That's a whole nother issue, public-private
mm-hmm.
partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
So you take any state under the administration's plan, they would then, if the plan is approved by Congress, be able to toll existing capacity, however, only under certain circumstances and with DOT approval. So we're a ways to go before that ever becomes law, if ever. But it is one way to allow states to get around some of these problems of having a sustainable funding source and to toll portions of interstate highways.
Are we going to find any kind of classically conservative liberal take on tolls?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, one thing that's interesting about the debate that's going on right now is that across the political spectrum, you have everyone from big labor, to the Chamber of Commerce, which is as establishment as it gets when it comes to free markets and things like that, all calling for an increase to the federal gas tax. Hmm. So, yes, some of these things may fall along partisan lines, but you're seeing now across the political spectrum groups calling for Washington to solve this problem once and for all and pass a long-range transportation plan, spending plan, and also to come up with a comprehensive program with some vision for the country and how we're going to handle our infrastructure problems.
You said that the Grow America Act put forth by the Obama administration is going to face heavy opposition in Congress, but it does raise some issues about how we spend our transportation dollars. For one, the bill would change how the money is doled out, not just by formula, but through competition and incentive-based funding. What are the pros and cons of that that you've heard?
One big pro possibly be getting these projects through the pipeline faster by streamlining the permitting process. Mm. Some people are opposed to that because when you kind of steamroll the approval process, some problems can crop up. But that is one positive aspect of it. And matter of fact, Secretary Fox brought up this point yesterday during his talk. Today, President Obama is speaking at the Tappan Zee Bridge in New York. A process that could have taken 15 years had they not streamlined it. And now they're going to get all the permitting done in maybe 5 years. So that's one positive there. Another reason why the administration's bill is going to face opposition or maybe not get enough support because it's only a one-time shot in the arm. It uses corporate tax reform to fund transportation by closing loopholes. Basically, it would raise $150 billion through taxes on overseas earnings and by closing loopholes that would normally let companies defer those obligations. So $150 billion is about half of the $302 billion the administration is proposing. That's only a one-time thing. You know, 4 years from now, we'd be stuck right back where we are now, trying to find a sustainable funding source.
And then just real quick, Martin DeCaro, before I let you go, the idea of intermodal funding streams. So we're not just talking about highways anymore. We're talking about systems of transportation and not just pavement. How is that idea? Is it catching on, or uh-huh. is it something that has this once again the usual people opposing it?
It's catching on in our urban areas. It really is. Mm-hmm. I think we're finally starting to see we're going in the right direction. Again, right being depending on who you ask. We're going in the right direction. It's still a slow transition. It's still tough because of car dependency. Mm-hmm. But vehicle miles travel was already declining before the recession, and the recession accelerated that decline, if you will. And vehicle miles traveled have not recovered since 08, 09. They're either stagnant or declining, depending on which study you look at. And we're starting to see regional planning, especially in this area, Washington, D.C., with Maryland, Virginia, mm-hmm. on making our system more connectable, connecting bike with transit, with the sharing economy. So when you have folks who don't own cars and living in a city like Washington, where 40% of households are car-free, we're seeing the market drive this, and now governments, local governments, respond to it and thinking more intermodally, multimodally. Okay, so we have all these residents pouring into our city who don't own cars. They mm-hmm. need to get around. We need to dedicate more funding to pedestrian and bicyclists. And I know that there's already some criticism of the proposals in Washington right now that there's not enough money for bike and walk. Mm-hmm. But connecting bike and walk to transit, making sure there are just something as simple as sidewalks to get people towards transit stations. To give you an example, Metro, which is the big subway system here in Washington, D.C., right. Metro has found that they can increase usage of their suburban transit stations by adding sidewalks more so than by building roads to those parking lots. It's really interesting. So, yes, it is taking off, but these are large investments, no matter which way you're looking at, whether you're going to pave more highways or build transit. Very large investments.
Martin DeCaro, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Martin DeCaro, he's a transportation reporter for WAMU Public Radio in Washington, D.C. Coming up, we'll get two points of view on the issue of transportation funding in the United States. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Station. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. The Federal Highway Trust Fund that has fueled construction and maintenance of our interstate roadways is running out and could conk out as early as August. Federal highway programs have been financed with federal gasoline taxes, but also in recent years with injections from the General Revenue Fund. But in any event, the tax rates that are considered the major funding vehicle for the trust fund have not changed in more than two decades, and there's no appetite in Washington to make a change in that way. One alternative is pay-as-you-go with toll roads, which is a proposal included in President Obama's Grow America Act, now before Congress. Joining us by phone to talk about that from Oregon is Cato Institute Senior Fellow on Transportation Issues, Randall O'Toole. Welcome to the show, Randall.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Joining us by phone from Washington, D.C. is David Goldberg of Transportation for America. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The Federal Highway Trust Fund is set to run out by August. Is everyone necessarily in agreement that this is a problem? Randall O'Toole.
Well, I think it's overstated as a problem. I think everybody understands that Congress is going to fix the Highway Trust Fund with another supplement of money. Mm-hmm. The real problem is that Congress insists on overspending. I mean, we know how much money is coming in, and Congress has been spending too much, and that's why it runs out of money.
Meaning spending too much, meaning spending more than it raises through the gasoline tax.
That's right. And it spends a lot of that money on non-highway projects. And so then they supplement the money with general funds, and people say that's a subsidy to highways. But if it hadn't spent the money on non-highway projects in the first place, it wouldn't have run out.
David Goldberg, what about the concern over the Federal Highway Trust Fund? Is it necessarily that big of a problem?
Well, I mean, the issue is that we've made a choice as a country to spend transportation dollars from the gas tax. That's the only way we have a reliable source of funding. You know, in Europe and elsewhere, they just simply budget for transportation infrastructure out of their general fund as a cost of doing business if you want to be a mature economy, which we certainly are. But we fund transit, yes, to a 20% basically of the gas tax money goes to transit, but it also goes to highways, and that money is threatened now because we're. You know, the good news is we're becoming more fuel efficient with our vehicles, and we're also driving less. We're a highly urbanized population. We're now 85% of us live in metropolitan areas, so we actually have less distance to cover, and the baby boomers are starting to retire, so they're not going to be commuting as much.
Mm-hmm.
So the gas tax receipts are actually falling. We have to make a decision as a country. Do we invest in our infrastructure, or do we not invest in our infrastructure? And that's kind of where we are right now.
The funding revenue for the Federal Highway Transportation Trust Fund is the gas tax. It hasn't increased for more than two decades. Randall O'Toole, should a tax increase be part of the equation? It's not keeping up when there's not enough money. One of the reasons is, as you point out, it's because some of it goes to transit. But otherwise, regardless, it's still not keeping up.
Well, I think it has been keeping up. The interesting thing is that you hear about the infrastructure crisis, but actually our state highways are in excellent condition. The number of bridges that are considered to be structurally deficient has declined every year for the last 20 years or more. The average smoothness of pavement has increased, meaning there's fewer potholes in the state highways. The roads that aren't in good condition are mostly local roads, and they're the ones that are funded out of general taxes rather than user fees like the gas tax. In general, things that are funded out of general taxes are not well maintained. This also includes our transit systems, which have a $78 billion maintenance backlog and growing because the transit agencies aren't spending enough to maintain the systems in the poor condition in which they already are. So I really support the use of more user fees and less general funds so that we can have good maintenance of our systems.
David Goldberg?
That makes no sense whatsoever. You know, you're on one hand, you're saying let's not use a gas tax for anything but for roadways, but let's not raise any other fees or any other taxes to pay for a backlog of maintenance and transit and that sort of thing. We have to make a decision as a country. Are we a first world country or a third world country? And for a first world country, then we maintain our systems and we build the things that we need to build to get people where they need to go and goods to market. And I think that's where we are right now. We have to make a decision as a country. We started building highways and bridges in earnest in this country in the 1950s, mm-hmm. and that stuff is getting old, and it is starting to fall apart. We have 65,000-plus structurally deficient bridges right now. We have bridges turning 50 every single day. The average bridge is 44 years old. The design life before it needs to be repaired or replaced in a major way is 50 years. So we are coming to a point where, you know, Randall is right. We 20-some years ago, we recognized that we were in a bad situation with bridges. We actually created a bridge fund to fix it. 2 years ago, Congress eliminated the bridge fund. So, you know, now we're in a position where the bridges are getting older. They're turning to the age where they have to be repaired or replaced, and we have no system for fixing that. We've got to do something.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how we fund our transportation systems in the United States. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Randall O'Toole, U.S. Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox, has said that Congress has not shown a willingness to think 10, 20, 30 years out. And to what extent should planners look ahead in charting a course for the nation's transportation needs? For example, should it matter that the U.S. population will rise from 296 million it was in 2005 to 438 million by 2050? Is that something we need to think about when we talk about moving people around?
I think planners have done a really lousy job of looking ahead and figuring out what we need in the future. David has talked about us being a first world country, and we're building third world systems. We're building obsolete rail transit systems. Planners are planning for the 19th century. What's the future of transportation? It's driverless cars. Driverless cars are going to lead to a huge increase in mobility because you won't have to be a licensed driver to be able to travel around anymore. It's going to be cheap. It's going to be a lot cheaper than public transit to take a driverless car. We'll probably see a lot more car sharing with the driverless car systems, and we'll see a lot more travel with driverless cars. And yet planners aren't thinking a thing about driverless cars. They're talking about building streetcars, which is an 1880s technology, as if that's going to be some kind of solution to our planning problems, to our transportation problems.
Well, what if they drive?
No, I don't think planning is the solution for.
What if they build driverless streetcars? I mean, the driverless concept could be expanded to mass transit, right?
Well, you're applying a 21st century solution to a 19th century technology. That's not going to work. The reason why automobiles work is because they take you where you want to go when you want to go there. Streetcars and other rail transit takes you to where somebody else wants you to go when somebody else allows you to go there. That's just not going to be popular. And that's why transit accounts for only about 1% of all travel in this country, and cars account for 85%.
David Goldberg, I want you to respond to what Randall O'Toole said, but also remember, looking back at that he says that planners have done a lousy job in the United States of planning ahead for the decades to come.
Oh well, I would agree that we haven't done the greatest job in the world of planning in a whole lot of respects. I think it's funny to say that some technology is completely obsolete because it has its origins in some other century. You know, I mean, we've been walking for thousands of years, millions, you know, and yet somehow that still works. I think that we're going to need everything in the future because, look, 85% of us live in metropolitan areas now. We are a highly concentrated population. It's going to get more so, and it's going to get more of us living in tighter spaces. So there's simply not going to be space enough for everybody to get around in a driverless car. I think driverless cars are kind of a cool idea. You could imagine a situation in which they could be trained up and become a sort of de facto public transit system, you know, in their own right. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, we're going to need a lot of different things. Look, millennials these days, they're moving to places where they don't need a car because they can't afford it in a lot of cases, and a lot of times they don't want to have the car. And what are they doing? They're using car share, they're using bike share, they're using their bikes, they're walking, they're using transit when they need to use transit. So we really sort of need the all the above strategy. We can't get by saying, oh, well, you know, there'll be some magic technological fairy that will come along and fix everything. So, you know, really, why plan and why invest?
Randall O'Toole, when we're talking about the nation's transportation system, should we be talking about intermodal issues? Should one of the ideas in the president's proposal is to think about the plans going forward intermodally, not just in terms of the highways and the pavement?
Well, again, I want to stress the difference between systems that are funded out of user fees and systems mm-hmm. that are funded out of tax dollars. Somebody with the Department of Transportation says that Congress likes to fund ribbons, not brooms. In other words, they like to have grandiose capital projects that they can have photo ops at ribbon cutting ceremonies, but then they won't maintain them, and the systems fall apart. Look at the Washington, D.C. subway system, which is having problems almost weekly with broken rails, smoking tunnels, and things like that.
The trains used to be guided by computers, and now they're guided by humans
because they don't trust the computers anymore because they're not maintaining them.
What user fee would you impose to fix the Washington transit system?
I think the Washington transit system is obsolete. We should phase it out and replace it with buses that can move more people at a far lower cost. And then we can pay for them out of user fees rather than having a multi-billion-dollar system.
Do you think we could charge fares that people would actually pay to cover the entire cost? Do you think, for example, that we could even charge a gas tax that would cover the entire cost? Like you said, 90% of the roads out there are local roads. Well, how are they maintained? They're maintained out of general funds. Do you think we could add a gas tax that people would actually be willing to pay at the pump to cover all the costs of automobiles? No, there's absolutely no way that would happen.
But we have to
face the fact that infrastructure is a cost of doing business in a mature economy. We have to pay it from somewhere.
Okay, Randall O'Toole, you want to respond to that? What about the societal investment in infrastructure for transportation? Is there a role for that?
Well, you know, there's a difference between investment and pork barrel spending. Hmm. Investment, you get something back from. But if you just spend money, you end up building a lot of expensive things that don't produce anything. Baltimore has a subway system like the Washington, D.C. subway system, but it carries fewer people than a light rail. And we're building high-cost transit systems all over the country that carry very few people just because Congress has money to pass out, and so cities try to grab that money.
The bill would change how the money is doled out, this idea, not just by formula, but through competition and incentive-based funding. Does that put some states at an unfair advantage? You call it promising, but couldn't it politicize the funding stream, too, like Randall O'Toole is describing?
Well, I would agree with Randall on a couple of points here. One is that we've had a system since the 1950s where we collect the money for the federal gas tax, and we distribute it out to the states, and we say nothing to them but go spend it. That's the way it's worked, and there have been incredible pork barrel highway projects. We know that. We all remember the Bridge to Nowhere. There's been lots of poorly thought through spending, and I would agree there have been poorly thought through transit projects built as well. However, on the transit side of things, the local folks are raising at least half or more of the amount of money that they're spending. So they're going to the voters, they're making a case, and increasingly those projects that are getting built they're pretty smart projects, and they do pretty well. They usually exceed their ridership projections. On the highway side, nobody has to rationalize anything. The state DOT comes up with something, some politician wants to build a project, they've got the money, they just go build it. They don't have to make a case for it. They don't have to go to the voters for it. So we do think that that introducing competition into the equation and having more situations where you actually have to go and make a case, what's the economic payoff? What problem are we solving here with this investment? And then it does become an investment that does actually have a return that you can demonstrate. And I think Randall's right about that. We should think about investing and about really rationalizing our projects and showing what the payoff will be before we just go spend the money.
Well, I think David's got his history wrong. To start with, the Bridge to Nowhere was a congressional earmark. It was not a project that the state of Alaska wanted to fund, and that's why they had to make an earmark out of it. The highway funds that have been distributed through a formula have led to highways that are well-maintained. The competitive grants that we've distributed to transit agencies have led to transit systems that are poorly maintained and getting worse all the time.
So yeah, you're arguing well, let's start the system and then accuse them of being poorly maintained. I don't think
Funding, if there's not a regular funding stream, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about roads or transit
That's
systems.
Exactly
it's
right.
it's
That's exactly right.
They can't depend on it going forward. We will continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We're talking about how to pay for our interstate highway system and whether any plan should be intermodal in concept versus strictly road-related. Still with us is David Goldberg with Transportation for America and also Randall O'Toole. He's a Cato Institute Senior Fellow on Transportation Issues. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We sort of just cast aside the increase, the gas tax issue, as it's not going to happen in Washington. It's not politically palatable. This caller, Jonathan in Columbus, you're wondering why that is. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, I have a comment and a question. First, the comment is that the gas prices around here have fluctuated 70 cents a gallon in the last year. So in that context, I'm wondering how a 15 cent tax increase won't be accepted and even forgotten after a couple of months. But my question is the only argument I hear against increasing the gasoline tax is the general argument of not increasing taxes. Is there a specific argument not to raise this specific tax? And I can take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Jonathan. Randall O'Toole, you want to take a swipe at that first?
Yes. The gas tax is a user fee, but it's not a very good user fee. And it doesn't, for example, give users a signal of how expensive the roads are that they're driving on. It doesn't give the highway producers, the highway managers, a signal of where people want to go and so where they ought to expand capacity or improve roads or whatever. So we need a better system that has better signals. Simply raising the gas tax will be a one-time solution that will go away because cars are getting more fuel efficient. Inflation will absorb some of the difference. So we're going to have to revisit this over and over again. I support the use of a vehicle mile fee where we guarantee people's privacy, but we also charge people where they go so that the tax that they pay goes to pay, or the fee that they pay goes to pay for the roads they actually use and not the roads that somebody else uses.
And when you say vehicle mile fee, you mean mile fee. You mean
vehicle mile fee, yes.
Tolls.
Well, you could call it a toll.
Okay.
You're just paying by the mile.
Right.
And when you drive on a Virginia state highway, you pay to the state of Virginia. When you drive on a county road, you pay to that county.
David Goldberg.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, theoretically, that's a good idea. The practicalities of it are a little bit tough. And Oregon's interesting because they have been piloting a vehicle mile fee, and I do think that something like that is probably in our future because the gas tax is going to be less and less effective. And I also think we are probably going to see more tolling, like it or not. It does, as Randall say, give you the signal, you know, by time of day or by congestion as to whether or not it's a high demand corridor. And so, but the way to make something like that fair, if you're tolling roads that we've already paid for, essentially, is to be using that money to control congestion and to provide an alternative to it. So if you build an alternative, say rail or rapid bus line or something like that in that corridor, then you know, then you're actually providing an alternative to the congestion, so that makes it more fair. I think there's a ways to go before that becomes politically acceptable, but I do think that's in our future.
Both of you have responded to that question about why not raise the gas tax with pretty long-term visions about how the funding stream should work and what our plans are for the future. But why not? The gas tax hasn't been increased in over 20 years. Why not increase it in the short term, at least, Randall O'Toole? How much of big of a deal would it be to even raise it by 5 cents a gallon, not even the 10 cents that I think our earlier guest, Martin DeCaro, said would be what would get them to the break-even point?
One of the problems I have is that we're already spending a lot of money on rail transit systems that people don't use very much, that are mainly making a few rail contractors and rail car manufacturers rich, but are not providing good transportation for people. I think a lot of the advocates of raising gas taxes simply want to transfer more money to build rail transit. The gas taxes we have today, even though it hasn't been raised in 20 years, is perfectly adequate to fund all of our state highways. We don't need more gas taxes for the roads and bridges.
What about
they want more gas taxes so that they can have more rail park.
What about the argument that when you take some people off the roads, there's less wear and tear? So when you provide alternative transportation options, there's less wear and tear on the road. So then, in a way, that's a benefit to the roads.
That would be a good argument if building new transit took people off the roads, but it doesn't. In 1980, my former hometown of Portland, transit carried 10% of commuters to work every day. Then they built 5 light rail lines, a streetcar line, and a commuter rail line. And today, transit carries less than 7.5% of commuters to work to every day. So we spend a lot on transit, and it doesn't get people out of their cars. It does get people off of buses and onto rails or something like that. But we're actually seeing declines in transit ridership in Portland because people who are used to ride transit are bicycling and walking. And that's fine for people who like to bicycle and walk, but it doesn't get people out of their cars.
David Goldberg?
Well, yeah, sure it does. I mean, the truth is that Portland and a lot of cities these days, there are a lot of different ways to get around, and you're not necessarily obligated to go out and spend thousands of dollars a year on a vehicle or multiple vehicles per household, which is a good thing. And the corridors that are served in Portland by the rail lines actually carry a huge share of people who are going to work along those lines. So you can look at it regionally, and yeah, sure, Portland has grown. It has had an urban growth boundary, but it's still gotten much bigger in its suburbs. And so, of course, there are people who are going to have to drive because they've really got no option. Transit doesn't go absolutely everywhere, but the places that it does serve, people are walking to transit and biking, and they're using the transit system. So it really does work. It works in Portland. It works in lots of places. Of course, you can't even imagine a New York City or a San Francisco Bay Area without their transit systems. Where would you put all the cars? How would people get anywhere? So, I mean,
actually,
it has its place. I would agree that just simply to go out and build a line that nobody's going to ride would be a silly idea. But the truth is, transit projects have to go through lots of hoops, and they actually, do a lot of different things apart from just moving people. They offer you a way to organize how you grow. You can develop around the transit systems. We've seen that happen in a lot of places. We've seen the value of homes and the value of property stay high through the recession, through the real estate bubble, around transit, where it collapsed out on the urban fringe where Randall would love to live and have to drive his car.
Randall O'Toole, what about that? I mean, there are some places where mass transit does work. Where would we be without mass transit in New York City?
Well,
you're
New
not
York
blank.
City,
you have, are you? This is not a blanket condemnation of mass transit.
Well, first of all,
he hates rail. He just hates rail. He goes around the country railing
okay.
against rail. That's
all right. Well, no, but Randall O'Toole, seriously, I mean,
let's distinguish between rail transit and mass transit. Mass transit includes buses.
Great.
And buses are very effective in almost every city in America.
But I mean, people that are traveling from rail from Philadelphia to New York City alone every day is gigantic. Where would they go?
Well, Megabus takes people from Philadelphia to New York City for a fraction of the cost of Amtrak or the transit systems. and it does it without almost any subsidies. We have
but
a
how
lot
many megabytes?
Well, wait a minute, David. Let him please.
We have a lot of examples of bus transit working very effectively, and yet we have these federal slush funds that encourage cities to build rail transit, and so we end up with seriously transit lines to nowhere. Portland built a rail transit line from one suburb to another suburb, and it carries so few people that it would be cheaper to give every daily round-trip rider a new Toyota Prius every single year for the rest of their lives than to run this rail transit line. And yet Portland likes to think of it as a great success because they got it built, they made some contractors rich, and they
what about car
manufacturers rich.
What about in, you know, four decades when the baby boomer generation ages and there's, you know, 84 million people over the age of 65 versus the 43 million now? What about then? I mean, you're saying, Randall, that the things like the driverless technology will take over at that point. I don't think when I'm 94 years old, I'm going to be able to afford a driverless car. I won't be able to afford anything, probably. Really, who's going to be able to afford that? There's going to be a lot of us out there that aren't going to be able to drive ourselves and are going to be depending on mass transit. Isn't a variety part of the picture or not? You're saying just buses.
Well, you know, you have this idea that because there's an alternative mode, that somehow that's creating a variety. You know, dirigibles are an alternative.
Okay.
Helicopters are an alternative. Being shot from cannons is an alternative mode of transportation.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean we should have the federal government spend billions of dollars to have put cannon emplacements all over our cities.
Driverless technology is going to cost a lot of money. It's costing a lot of money. The driverless cars, I mean, it could be decades, as we mentioned, and everybody knows before it's something that's useful on the highways. What about public funding of driverless technology to make it more affordable and to speed up the process? Do you have any?
I don't think we need public funding. It's not going to cost a lot. There are cars made today that are 95% driverless, and all you have to do is install a couple of sensors and give them a software upgrade. It'll cost about $500 per car to make those cars driverless.
Yeah. But the truth is
they're
driverless, but they're not
in 2020.
They have to have space to drive on. They have to have space to park. The problem we've got in our cities and our suburbs is we don't have the space for more cars. That's just a fact of physical limitations. So we can make them driverless, and we can do some interesting things with driverless technology, and I'm not against it at all. But there will have to be some kind of publicly supplied infrastructure for that stuff to drive on and places for it to park, and that's an issue.
Except driverless cars, because they're going to have computer reflexes instead of human reflexes, will triple to quadruple the capacity of our roads to handle traffic. And yes, there might be parking problems, but if you just tell your car, go find a parking place, it'll drive around until it finds a parking place.
Hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Or go pick up another passenger and earn me some money, be a car-sharing vehicle. So maybe the need for parking will decline as car-sharing increases. But the point is, if you're the first driverless cars are expected to be on the market by 2020. By 2040, more than half the cars on the road will be driverless,
okay.
And we'll start seeing states close highways to human-driven vehicles, because driverless cars will be so much safer. And if you're a baby boomer who wants to age in place, which most people do, it'll be a lot more convenient to have your driverless car, which is an ordinary car that has some driverless technologies in it, to take you where you want to go than it will be to walk a quarter mile to a transit station, wait for the transit system to come pick you up, drop you off somewhere where you have to walk another quarter mile.
I'm gonna take a call right now. Mike and Gahanna, you're on the air. Welcome, Mike.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My question is, you know, they're talking about wages going up and expenses going up on all this. Why don't you just change the equation here? Everybody, you know, they've got the Davis-Bacon Act that says you have to pay prevailing wage. That was a law that was made some time ago. Why don't we just scrap that law? We don't have to pay prevailing wage. You just have people come in and bid on whatever the cost is going to be. You could probably save 30%. They did that here in Ohio when they had the last administration, and they had a big union guy running the building of the schools. When we stopped doing that, we saved 30% of the taxpayer money. bid differently on the materials that you need.
So lower the cost of construction, in other
absolutely,
words.
Absolutely. I mean, we're all going
so instead of
okay.
you paying more of a gas okay. tax, take the wages.
Thanks, Mike. Yep. Go ahead, David.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess you know, that could work in some cases, but I mean, what you're basically saying is don't ask me to pay more for my infrastructure. Take it away from the wages of the workers, which doesn't seem to be all that sustainable. I mean, at some point, you can only take so much money away from people before there's nobody to do the work. So, yeah, that may work in some cases, but that's not going to be the total solution.
Randall O'Toole, lower the costs through wages?
I think I agree with David. That's a part of the solution, but it's not the main part of the solution. Well, what I see is cars cost Americans, we spend about 24 cents a passenger mile driving around. And there are subsidies to driving, but they add up to about a penny a passenger mile. So 25 cents a passenger mile for travel, including all subsidies. Compared to that, rail transit is really, really expensive. Rail transit riders spend about 24 cents a passenger mile in fares, so it sounds cheap compared to driving, or about the same, but the subsidies are much, much greater. They're about 75 cents in most mm-hmm. cases on the average. In some cases, they're a lot more, as much as $3 a passenger mile to ride, for example, the Charlotte light rail line. So we have these really expensive rail lines out there, and we try to pretend they're cheap because we subsidize them so much that we make the fares accessible, and yet they're more expensive than buses.
The participation in mass transit, you think, is going to remain static, that it won't change over time?
Well, you know, the transit advocates like to compare current numbers with 1995, which was a low for transit. Mm-hmm. But at the time that we nationalized our transit systems or municipalized them in about 1970, the average urban American rode transit about 50 times a year. We've spent, since then, $1 trillion subsidizing transit in capital improvements and operations. And today, the average American rides transit less than 44 times a year. So we've seen a decline in per capita urban transit ridership despite all this money put into it. I think we should privatize our transit systems, let the private operators run buses where people want to go, when they want to go there, and I think we'll see a resurgence in transit ridership because the transit systems will be responsive to the users rather than to the politicians who want to build expensive rail lines that people don't really need.
David Goldberg, the criticism that the transit systems, the mass transit systems, aren't responsive to what people really need, fair or what?
Yeah, no, I don't know that that's necessarily true. I think that's a very simplistic argument. You know, what we've seen in the last several years is the increasing numbers of people moving actually to our cities and to our closer in suburbs, and they're looking for ways to either to save money by how much they drive, driving less, or not even having a car. They're looking for other ways to get around. The rail systems that have been built, you see neighborhoods pop up around them. They've got housing, they've got shopping, they've got offices around them. So those are places that have become new neighborhoods that are accessible for people. It's working in a lot of different levels. I think there's no doubt but that we're going to become an increasingly more concentrated population, 85% of us in metro areas now. So look, we've got to do something. There's only so much urban space. We've got to figure this out one way or another. I don't object to the idea of of new technologies being a part of the solution, but I just don't see driverless cars, for example, as being the total solution. I think we're going to do a little bit of everything. People are using bike shares in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. like crazy. They're using car shares. They're doing things that we're, you know, with smartphones now, we can do things that we hadn't anticipated, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. And I think more of that's going to become true. I think Randall's right that we should be careful about where we invest in some of this infrastructure, but there's mm-hmm. no doubt that rail is going to be a part of the solution.
David Goldberg, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
David Goldberg, he's with Transportation for America, and Randall O'Toole, Cato Institute Senior Fellow on Transportation Issues. Randall, thanks as well to you.
Thank you.
Two different, very different views on the future of transportation in the United States. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.